Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, friends of America's Most Haunted. I am absolutely thrilled and delighted in just our third show. Man, every show has been better than the one before, but I don't want to say that because they've all been equally great. I suppose it's mounting as we go and everything is accumulating. And wow, we had all kinds of activity today. I don't know if you saw Teresa on Twitter. Lots going on. Erin Ryder herself was participating in letting the world know. We got all kinds of retweets. I think we picked up half as many new followers today as we've had. Of course, we've really only been had that account up for about a week. But anyway, I'm Eric Olson, and with me is my partner in all things America's Most Haunted, Teresa Argy, and we also have a special guest before we even get to Erin Ryder. So hi, Teresa. Who do you have there with you?
Oh, Eric, I know you are my partner in almost everything but my other partner, Kathy Weber. My Haunted Housewife partner is here tonight with us. Since we do finish each other's sentences, it was only appropriate that she be on tonight as we interview Erin Ryder because, you know, us chicks have to stick together. Hi,
Heck
Eric.
Yeah.
Thanks for welcoming me.
My pleasure. Absolutely. No question about it. Let's see here. Do we have a call? Who might that be? Already? Hello? Who's there? 440 area code? How?
Eric, I think that might just be me.
That might just be you? How about this one? 440 area code?
Tim in Ohio.
All right. Well, please hold on because it looks like we now have our special, extra, special, super-duper guest star appearing over our very phone lines. Is this the world-famous Erin Ryder?
Hi, Eric and Teresa, it is. And Kathy, hi, guys.
Hi, Erin.
Hi, Erin, how are you? Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
My question is how did you get to a 310 number so quickly from Sweden, because I just saw you there not more than 5 minutes ago?
I know. Can you even stand it? I still had the amazing tank that I was driving around in Kazakhstan, so.
That was quite an episode, I must say. You are intrepid as all get out, and wow, how buff. Here you are beating up on Josh, arm wrestling. You're whacking on the strength. What do you call that thing? The strength meter thingy you whack on and it goes up and rings the bell.
This was absolutely an episode for me and my biceps. I'm actually surprised that my biceps got way more camera time than I did.
Well, I'll tell you, you are nothing if not badass, you know? That is the bottom line. So why don't we give a little introduction for those who, been living in a hole, perhaps. Ryder, Erin Ryder, has bounded her way to co-starring status on Sci-Fi's globetrotting paranormal investigation show Destination Truth and Nat Geo's zippy new Chasing UFOs. But she's far from just another pretty face, though she has one. And Lean Bud, she has that too. Laura Croft, Amelia Earhart, Dana Scully. Whether in fiction or nonfiction, few females are as tough as nails as Erin Ryder. Ryder's unique perspective and determination have taken her around the globe to research claims of the strange and mysterious, all the while traversing some of the deadliest environments on Earth. All right, it's obvious I'm reading. If you guys are listening to the show, you can get the rest of it right off of the page of the show. But I'm telling you, it's a lot of really amazing stuff that you have done. The Great Wall of China, boy, I sure remember that episode. Glaciers in Antarctica, the world's largest waterfall rafting. And here you are, besides being intrepid and funny and having a ingratiating but boorish personality, which I love. What a combination, man. Is that the perfect woman or what? But you are also a tech expert. How did all of this come to be? How do you find yourself in this position? I know you actually do have, and not to, you know, to minimize your the shape you're in, but I know you also have quite an athletic background as well.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where somehow, you know, throughout all my hard work in school and television and athletics, I've managed to kind of combine everything I love into, I say a job, but that's not fair because I literally get to go out and travel and play every day. It's been an incredible experience. I've kind of always been intrigued by the mystery of the paranormal and, you know, different myths and legends that are out there. So that has always intrigued me. But to be able to then travel the world and look into these claims and talk to all these eyewitnesses, it's been kind of a dream come true. And I, you know, if someone said, how did you get there? I really couldn't pinpoint one particular thing. I would just say I worked really hard and, you know, I have a lot of really great people that have been by my side. I mean, you know, Josh Gates, one of the best guys I know out there. And, you know, I wouldn't be anywhere if it wasn't without him or the team. But in terms of the tech stuff, I think, you know, growing up within this industry, as you guys know, being investigators, there's really no, you know, ghost hunting tool. You just have to kind of be, you know, smart and utilize items that may not exactly be, you know, for this particular job. So I've just become fascinated with the technology, thermal cameras and night vision cameras, EMF detectors and, you know, tri-field meters. It's just become something that I've just, you know, kind of poured myself into. And I can't say I went to school for it, but I can tell you I probably know the ins and outs better than a lot of the guys on the team.
Well, you've learned the most important and I suppose the most efficient way is you've had to do it. You've had to know how to use them, and you've been out in the field where there was no one else to rely upon other than yourself.
Oh yeah, you'd be surprised what experience and, you know, just some jungle know-how to kind of fix things. You know, you just automatically become MacGyver when you realize that you're out in the middle of nowhere and you have to make it work. So,
what was that first experience that combined some form of tech work or tech knowledge with investigation and or, say, adventure? What was the first thing that comes to your mind that you can recall where those things started coming together?
Well, I guess, you know, the first season of Destination Truth was really, you know, season two. And, you know, I sat with, at the time, Casey Brummels and Brad Coleman, and we just, you know, put our heads together and figured out what are we going to need this season to go out there. And I just kind of threw myself into it and began researching what everyone else was using and then trying to think of other ways to, you know, utilize different cameras and different rigs and, you know, talking to different companies and seeing what they would recommend while we're out there. So season two is really when this all started coming about. You know, the groundwork was already laid with the guys out there. It was just a matter of how do we now do it better. So that was the first time. But then I've worked on other shows. On Cartoon Network, I worked on a show called The Other Siders with a really great team of young investigators. We did the same thing there. And then on Chasing UFOs, I've kind of, you know, using that same kind of know-how to utilize different instruments all over again. So it's been, you know, kind of a running through line since, I guess, now for the past 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Hey, I don't want to monopolize. Please go ahead, Teresa and Kathy.
Aaron, you're also a producer for these shows as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. On both of them, I'm a co-executive producer.
So you have a lot of input which goes into each episode and the making of each episode, I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, I will say, obviously, you know, there are executive producers and, you know, the network does have a large say in exactly what happens. But I think, you know, in terms of getting what we want when we're out there, we absolutely, you know, have more freedom than I think a lot of shows have. And I think that that's really been beneficial to us, you know. But we know what we want before we go out there. We do a lot of research. And we just, you know, push the envelope. I think every time we go out there, you know, we set this skeleton. We're like, okay, here's what would be great. If we could talk to 5 eyewitnesses and go to this cave and, you know, eventually get to this area. But while we're out there, we want things to go wrong or go right, and we want it to all change and, you know, kind of, you know, be even better than what we had originally kind of structured out.
And how much prep time goes into each episode? I mean, the way that the shows move, especially Destination Truth, where, you know, in 5 seconds you go from getting to a cave, traveling 700 miles, three hours on a canoe, and then you're off in the middle of nowhere. And on TV it happens so very quickly, but obviously a lot of time has gone by, and the magic of TV makes it go by very quickly for the viewers. But
you mean you don't really go on that blue line on the map?
I wish it was that easy. I've clocked a lot of flight miles. No, each season takes about 2 or 3 months of just soul research, and that's you know, talking to people that have seen things, looking up articles, and then getting on the phone with locals and trying to find somebody that can be our eyes and ears on the ground while we're still even in the States. And then we head out there and we're on the road. And, yeah, I'd say you probably see about 1/8 of the actual travel that we do. We're in cars, in boats, in planes all the time. We are always moving. And, you know, at a particular location, we could be there from anywhere from 5 days to 8 days to when we were in Antarctica, we were there for over 2 weeks. So, and then when we come back, it's all about getting all the material that we've collected. Then we've got to go through it all and then bring it to different experts and, you know, and try to, you know, get some sort of a finale to all this work that we've done. So all in all, it could take from 6 months to a year for a whole season to be done.
When you are on location, it appears you're really isolated. Is it true that you're isolated, or is there a production crew with you?
We're it. We are absolutely it. You know, there's times where you may not see you know, a local expert in terms of, you know, someone who's got a weapon, because we don't come armed. So if we're in an area where we are fearful about larger animals or even, you know, some other tribes or locals that, you know, might not be as friendly to, you know, investigators running around in the middle of the night with cameras on their heads. So sometimes we do have security with us, but what you see is what you get. You know, this season it's myself and Josh. Kyle and Dave are on camera. We have Adam as audio. Tristan is tech. Richie's the medic, and Katie's another producer, and that's it. That's all we have out there except for, you know, maybe one local person helping out. And, you know, it's a good thing because you travel small and you can get around really quickly, but at the same time, you know, you have to wear a lot of hats and definitely don't get as much sleep as one would think.
I think it's a really honest way to present the show, because so many of the other investigation shows, you know, there's obviously have to be people who you don't know who they are. You know, usually they don't introduce the camera people or even show the camera people. The fact that your team is treated as a team and you're all given the honor of being on camera and being included as part of that team, I think that gives it a sense, kind of a more holistic approach, and I think it's a more honest approach, and I think that's one of the great things about the show.
We're glad people see it that way, because that's exactly what we wanted. We just wanted this purity of a team that when you go out there, because, you know, you do realize that there is a lot of hocus pocus that could go on. It is television. It is quote-unquote reality television, and you do have to be wary about, you know, the things that are going on, but we can't pull that off. I mean, you know, there's so few of us, and it's really just run and gun at the time, and basically, you know, people are like, oh, well, it's always so exciting, and there's always so much action, and it's like, well, if you've been shooting almost 24 hours for 7 days a week, I promise you there are going to be some exciting moments. Can't always promise you that, but once you dilute it down to 22 minutes, you're going to definitely get some heart racing, heart pumping moments, and you're not going to have to fake that, because it just legitimately happens when you're in places that you don't know and you're up against obstacles that are like waterfalls or glaciers or, you know, a forest in the middle of Romania that people refuse to go to.
where individuals are yanked backwards through thin air. I still can't get over that. That is still probably the single craziest paranormal moment that I've seen on TV.
Unfortunately not being out there during that season, because Jael was out there, I was desperate to go. I really was. If we weren't going, I was probably going to plan my own trip. So I was really happy that I got to go out there. And I tell you what the craziest part of all of it was, Josh and I getting on the phone with Evan and trying to talk him back into going. Because
God, I can imagine.
You know, he's a really strong, smart, brave guy, but he's just like, I don't know why you guys are asking me this. There's so many other people that could go out there. And it was like, well, obviously you had something there. There was something else there. And we just wanted to see if it was a moment, a fluke, or if it was, you know, something else. So I'm really glad he went. I think obviously it was brave and probably a little bit stupid, but it was truly an incredible experience. I mean, you guys know as investigators, there's some places you walk in and you just feel it, and you just know without even talking to each other that this is going to be powerful, and this is going to be one of those nights that you're not going to forget. I'm getting like chills right now just even just talking about it.
Well, it was amazing that he had yet another experience. I mean, it's almost like on demand. Hey, Evan, let's go there and see what happens to you next.
And he had a bleed for it, too.
Yeah, that was nuts. Hey, Aaron, do you mind if we take a question from a caller?
Oh, I would love that. I would love that.
All right, so let me see if I can figure out the technology here. And we will bring in, was it Tim? I'm sorry, in 440 in Ohio?
Yes, sir. My name's Tim. Good evening.
Good evening. Do you have a question for Aaron Ryder?
Yes. Hello, Aaron. I'm a big fan. I tweet you all the time. I was curious.
And that's illegal in some places.
Yeah. She jams. There is no Laura Croft or anybody else. She's the one and only. When you guys do water investigations, and I know I'll probably answer my own question once I ask it, why don't you use thermal cams underwater?
We do. You know, it's not as easy as one would think because water temperature is pretty. Well, the whole thing here is, you know, when you're looking for an underwater creature, a lot of the times they're cold blooded anyway. And then thermal cameras aren't as great underwater for a lot of reasons because the temperatures are so strong that you're just going to see. You know, one color, unlike when you're, you know, up on the land. It's the same with humidity and thermal cameras. It kind of blocks out a lot of the IR. So they're not as great to use. We do use them sometimes. I love it. I think it's just another opportunity to get some other readings that you might not get. But at the same time, they're not as consistent as one would hope they are, like they are on the ground.
Well, that's a good question. I had never thought of that. Yeah, it makes sense. Your answer, of course, too, that obviously the water is going to be closer to more or less all the same temperature than you would have on land where you have such discrepancies between living creatures at, you know, 90-plus degrees and the air temperature, especially when it's a little bit cooler.
Okay, sweet. I don't want to hold it up. I know there's a lot of
people.
All right,
great question. Thank you very much. Let us move on, and let's try 724 area code.
How about Teresa and Kathy?
Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
Hello. Good, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Hello.
Good. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, please do proceed because, man, we only have an hour, and these things fly.
No problem. Aaron, I just wanted to say how much of a big fan I am. I do tweet you occasionally, and I get retweeted by you occasionally, and that makes me giddy like a little schoolgirl. But the question I have for you is, you're a very athletic person, you know, as seen in some of the recent investigations you've done. Did you play any youth sports when you were a child?
I did. My parents were incredibly athletic themselves, and they just let me try everything. Growing up, I played soccer, softball, volleyball, basketball. I eventually played field hockey in college, and we won a national championship. Even now, I still play beach volleyball, and I run. But it's definitely something. I'm kind of a team player to begin with, but sports have always been a part of my life, and one of the reasons why I am still as fit as I am is because I still, you know, love swimming and playing all the time.
I think that's an excellent point. I think the fact that you are so comfortable in a team environment, I think that really shows, you know, even beyond the athleticism, the fact that you know how to play and that you value, you know how to be a member of a team. I think that really comes through.
You know, it's one of those things where we do, Josh is really brilliant about the team aspect of all this, and it's really crucial to find the right people to go out on the road because it is 3 months or longer. So we're very hard during interviews and building who we're going to bring out on the road. And I think because of that, I've realized my strengths and weaknesses while I'm out there. And you just have to be careful with it. You know everyone's going to have a bad day. You just have to make sure that when they're having a bad day, you kind of push things aside, give them the support that they need. And then it's about taking care of yourself. You know better than anyone when you're tired, when you're cranky, and what you need to be happy. So you just make sure that you have that on the road, and then don't take for granted all these great spots that you're going to. And, you know, after that, a lot of it just comes easy because these are great people that you're traveling with.
Excellent. Well, let us move back to Teresa and Kathy.
Oh, we're still here. All
yeah,
right.
Those Ohio chicks.
Right. Can't get rid of us that easy, Eric.
Nor would I wish to.
Aaron, has there ever been an investigation in either on any of your shows, Destination Truth, Chasing UFOs, or even any of the other things that you've done? Has there ever been a situation that was so dangerous that you just had to bail? You couldn't complete your quest. You had to leave. You couldn't shoot the episode or finish what you were doing. And I'm not talking necessarily paranormal things. I'm talking about like dangers from the locals or the government or maybe even the environment. Has there ever been something that was just too much, too dangerous, and you just had to bail and not do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes that becomes part of the storyline, and sometimes that's just something that we don't like people to know about because, you know, it is sometimes just a little too dangerous to even kind of go into. This season on Chasing UFOs, we definitely have a couple run-ins with the Coast Guard and, you know, some different military on different levels. On Destination Truth, because we're out in the middle of nowhere more often than not, we don't usually have that kind of a dangerous obstacle like that. But we do have a lot of animals, a lot of weather conditions. I'd say the most scared I've probably ever been would be, gosh, there's so many jungle investigations. I guess there was one when we were in Indonesia, and I was with Gabe and Josh and Jared, our medic. And Gabe turned around, and there was a viper in the tree, perfect eye line with us. And Josh had just been bitten by a spider, and we couldn't recognize what the spider was. We were really concerned, trying to get him back to base camp. And you turn around, and there's this viper just looking you dead in the eye. And now you think, okay, well, this is already scary enough, but now you realize you might not even been noticing the other snakes that have been in the trees the entire night. So we didn't call it off. But we all kind of regathered and just made a different plan for the night. I think that's usually what kind of happens. We don't put anyone, if you're really scared or you feel you're in jeopardy, we'll, of course, you know, kind of take you out of that element or, you know, try to remove the obstacle that's really kind of, you know, making you the most nervous. But in that situation, it was best to just hightail it out of there and not kind of pursue. And there's a couple different cases where we're in caves and we hear something and you know that there's only one way out. And that's the other scariest thing. You always have an exit for when we're out there. We always have security when we're in certain locations. But I think the most dangerous to me are the insects and the snakes because they're kind of a little bit scary. For me, the bears and the tigers and all that stuff, I feel like, you know, they smell you before you smell them, and they just don't even want to deal with it. It's the little ones that you kind of, the silent but deadly, that I'm always extremely concerned about.
You don't see.
Well,
anyway.
The more I watch the show, the more I'm convinced that there's nothing you won't do. I'm always amazed at how brave you really are, and I think Josh has met his match. But I do have to tell you that we do belong to a sorority together, the Sisterhood of the Klutzes. And I want you to tell me, what is the worst injury that you've suffered on one of these trips?
Kathy is world famous for her falling on national television. So. 5 times.
That's,
in one episode.
That's incredible. That's right up there with what I'm used to. Like, people say I'm the most athletic klutz you could ever Your Honor. I just blame it on the fact that my brain's faster than my body. But the worst accident I've gotten into was when we were in Thailand, and I fell off a motorcycle and I ended up breaking my elbow. That was probably the biggest injury I've sustained. Of course, I've got a lot of, you know, scars and broken toes and broken fingers from the road. But when you're out in the middle of nowhere, and I mean, Rex is a saint above all saints. Rex Williams is my hero for a lot of reasons. But, you know, when it's only him out there, it's still a little bit scary because he doesn't have all he needs to do everything. So it made me a little bit nervous, but, you know, he was there, got me all stitched up, took me to the hospital. I got a cast on, and, you know, we were moving the next day. So that's probably the worst it's been. But I fall down more often than I probably stand up. So,
well, we appreciate the fact that you're not perfect, because then as women, we would have to hate you. And, you know, we don't want to do that because, you know.
I am far from it, and I'm not ashamed of admitting my faults, and a lot of them are the fact that I startle very easily and I can trip over my own foot, you know, just walking in the mall.
And I'm also one that admires your drunken sailor talk also.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I was raised by longshoremen and truck drivers.
I'm right with you. Yeah.
Hey, I have a follow-up that kind of fits in with that. Speaking of sort of the pinnacle, whether it be the worst or the best, what I'm really interested in, how has your personal philosophy on all of this evolved over time? I know you're a Scaliver, which is an excellent neologism, I think. I like that combination quite a bit, a skeptic and a believer. But over time, I imagine you've been on, is it hundreds now of investigations? I imagine it is. It's certainly many dozens anyway. You know, has your point of view changed at all? Have you run across anything that has changed how you view the world and the presence of the paranormal? And I'll leave that open-ended because obviously that takes in a lot of different things.
I will say that absolutely, you know, every investigation has, you know, changed me for one way or another. When I first started out, you know, I realized later now, looking back, I was a little bit closed-minded, and I wasn't always asking, you know, the right questions. I you know, kind of came to these conclusions in my own head, and I let those small little judgments maybe, you know, taint what I was feeling when we were out there. You know, maybe I wasn't as, you know, believing as I should have been. And now I just try to be really open-minded. There's no reason that any of this stuff can't be going on, because a lot of it just hasn't been proven false yet. You know, everyone's had these incredible experiences, and they can't all be liars, you know. And I think once you go out there and you realize that it's not just in the United States, it's not just in our own backyard that people are having these paranormal experiences, these strange sightings or creatures that perhaps you can't explain, you know, away, then you know that there's something else out there. And as a good scientist, you just have to narrow it down, and you have to say, okay, well, it can't be these, you know, few things, but what could it be? I think I've become much more open-minded. Especially if you saw the episode tonight in Kazakhstan, that happened way before I did anything with Chasing UFOs, and that was really the first time I saw something in the sky that I couldn't explain. Of course, I've had close family, and I had close families and friends who have seen stuff and spoke to me, you know, with secondhand stories. But that was my first opportunity to see something that I really couldn't explain. So that was really eye opening. And the same when we were, you know, in China, and I'm having these paranormal experiences that, you know, earlier they might have been more subtle, but I started feeling as though, because I was becoming more open to it, that I was letting in more and feeling more. And I just, it was this unbelievable tactile experience that, you just can't think that that there's nothing out there and that we have all the answers yet. So it makes me more excited and, you know, savor all that this beautiful world has for us. And I'm kind of happy that the answers aren't all out there yet because it would, you know, give us nothing to investigate. So I'm much more open-minded and I'm much more excited to go out there and talk to people and really learn about these experiences and have them myself.
Well, you kind of ran through the UFO side of it and the, say, the spirit world side of it. What about on the cryptid side? Which of your many adventures in that regard has seemed the most plausible or if, in fact, you have been convinced that one of these does actually exist?
You know, I think there are a few that are on the top of my list that I want to go back, and I would love to, you know, do some follow-up and some further information. The most plausible for me is in Indonesia. It's called the Orang Pendek, which means small human, a creature that is very much like a chimpanzee or monkey, but walks upright, more like a human. And the evidence in that particular case and the research that people have done, it's there for me. It just really is. You know, and I think even going into Vietnam this year and, you know, researching that story, it even opened up more doors to the Orang Pendek where I was like, Jesus, I wasn't even thinking about that at that time. So that one to me is the most plausible. But I would have to say that there are a couple up there where I think, you know what, if we went back, you know, because we did go back to Romania this year, if we have another follow-up, there could be some other ones that you see us go back to because we weren't completely satisfied with, you know, some of the evidence that we got.
Interesting. Teresa and Kathy, I think I cut you off probably more than once, but please go ahead.
No, you answered my question, but Kathy has a question for
Okay, I'm going to get back to the UFOs. Erin, I had read that you grew up in the Hudson Valley in New York and that you had been aware of some experiences of your relatives, your uncle and your grandfather in particular. And I wondered, I guess you were a virtual child at that time because this was back in the 80s and 90s.
As was I.
I was wondering
Me too.
What details do you recall that they told you about their experiences or what they had seen?
You know, the first sighting when it first came out was in 82, and yeah, I was you know, a real baby at the time. So when eventually I started hearing about the stories, when I remember them, I'm sure I heard about them when they originally happened. They were around 83 and 84, I think that's what they would say, was when I was a little bit older and I would, you know, not necessarily be sitting on my grandfather's lap, but, you know, kind of in that storytelling realm. And I remember him talking about this, you know, the easiest way he could describe it to me was like a boomerang, you know, and, you know, kind of like the toy and how he saw something in the sky and how it was unlike anything he'd ever seen. And, you know, my family would go back and forth. There's some believers and there's some non-believers. So it just became this really fun debate about what could be out there. My family's very open to that kind of stuff. So here I am, you know, learning about this for the first time, my grandfather telling me this, my uncle kind of filling in these details about the color and about, you know, it being this reddish and blue and, you know, how he thought it looked more like a triangle. And, you know, then later really knowing more about it with, you know, J. Allen Hynek's book, The Night Siege, and then realizing that it was this mass sighting that I had no idea about. I just assumed it was this localized event. Maybe my grandfather was making it up. Maybe they had been drinking a couple of too many Coors Lights. And now it's actually, you know, becoming to me so real that what they were telling me was something that they actually experienced. And it was just, it was fun for me because that's like, you know, that's how these stories get passed down from generation to generation. And so if they legitimately saw the same thing that these other people were seeing, then there's no reason that they were just seeing, you know, hand gliders at night or, you know, jumpers or flares or whatever, because why would they need to tell me a lie before I even knew that other sightings were even happening, which was really incredible to me. So I think I'd always wanted to see something after that. You know, we'd sit outside and I'd see falling stars and, you know, we'd you know, living out in in a non-city area, you could see so much more. Then I grew up and I went to the city and, you know, I kind of forgot about it. And being on Destination Truth, it reminds me of that history and about how these stories have been going on, and not only in other people's families, but in my own. And I really cherish that.
Unless it was a mass Coors Light event.
That's true. That is true. I have not followed up on that. I might have to do some research.
Speaking of UFOs, obviously, Destination Truth is very well established, has been around several years, is really quite well respected. Now you have this brand new entity in Chasing UFOs. What are your thoughts on how it's going thus far, and anything you can reveal about what is forthcoming?
You know, I think Chasing UFOs is a really new endeavor for National Geographic. Obviously, UFOs isn't something new to them, but I think this reality-driven content with live hosts is something that they're really newly getting into, and that was something really exciting for us, that they were undertaking a project that was new on a lot of different scopes for them. So it was a real risk, and they backed us, gave us a lot of support, and let, you know, James and Ben and myself have a lot of say in things that we might not have, you know, had this been another network. And we were really happy to work with them. We're not sure if there's going to be a season 2 just yet. They're waiting for the whole season to play out, and there's another episode coming up this Friday at 10, which is another great one. I'm super thrilled that the last few episodes that are coming out, they're international episodes coming out from Brazil and Mexico, stories that not many people even know about. So, you know, is it the definitive UFO hunt and chase? No, I don't think that's going to be out there for a while now. I think it's really hard for network television to get all of that into one programming and keep it entertaining. I think that's what documentaries are for, and I would absolutely, you know, keep doing what we're doing, because I think it's about right now igniting this interest in younger people, because I think UFOs is one of those things that gets stagnant from generation to generation. We just want that interest to stay out there, and we want it to be okay for scientists to start looking into these claims again and, you know, not be afraid that they're going to be ridiculed and, you know, mocked for really going out there and trying to find out what's going on. Because, again, you know, we talk about the mass Coors Light incident or any mass incident, they're seeing something. And if the government's not going to give us an answer, then we've got to do it ourselves. So that's what I'm hoping people really take away from all of this. And I think, you know, National Geographic has really supported us in that endeavor.
Now, what is your reaction to what's happened lately over the last few days or even last week with some of your co-stars speaking out against the network and the way that the show has portrayed them and their quest and the way the whole show is going? They've been very vocal about how unhappy they are with how some of the episodes have turned out, which I found surprising because I thought the show was getting better and better every week. And I thought that the relationship between the three of you was really becoming compelling and entertaining, and I thought it was good stuff. So I was kind of surprised to hear that. When Cassie and I had our little foray into TV, we had to sign like 50-page documents and swear on our children's lives we were not allowed to say anything negative about the show, the network, or anybody related to it, or we would lose our heads.
Or their mothers.
I was surprised to hear that. Wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, you know, the unfortunate thing is that James and Ben were taken a little bit out of context. They obviously didn't do an interview about this. They were kind of, you know, writing into a Facebook chain that was on, a partner of James's, Leslie Keene's, Facebook site. So here they are thinking that they're just kind of, you know, sharing some, I can't say personal because it is Facebook, but they're just kind of venting a little bit. The both of them have taken a lot of heat from this particular project. I've taken heat myself from it, and I think James is one of those guys that he's just a little bit reactionary, and I think everyone has an idea of what a project's going to be like in the beginning, and then at the end you think, oh, well, this could have been different or that could have been different. And I think, you know, it was late at night. He's had some family stuff going in it, and I just think that it was just more than he probably ever anticipated this to come into. You know, we went to Comic-Con last weekend, and, you know, it was last weekend, the weekend before, but it was thrilling to be with them and, you know, hear from them, and they were so sorry that that's how this all happened, because they are really happy with National Geographic, and I think we're never going to see eye to eye with everything. You know, that's just the way that it is, you know.
So you're always going to have a conflict. I mean, it's just it's inherent between a television program, which involves so many different elements, most importantly, post-production, as we all know. It always comes down to the post-production. And when people do not have complete control over that, and, you know, how many people do, it's inherent that you're going to have different points of view and some conflicts on how things are presented and in terms of context and all that. To me, it seems inescapable, and all you can really do is just make the most of it and do the best you can.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I also think for this particular show, as anyone kind of knows watching shows, the first season is a little bit of trial and error, right? You're going out there, you're trying to bring back the best show possible, and everyone's still trying to figure out what are people going to love, what are people going to hate, and that's a guessing game that's really difficult, and sometimes you nail it and sometimes you don't. But once you walk away and you start going into season two, you start getting into your stride, and like you said, you know, the later episodes, the connection between all three of us and, you know, the way we go about the investigation is almost completely different than the beginning episodes. So I think if season two came about and, you know, if myself and James and the production company and the network all sat down in one room together, you know, it would be a big collaboration of ideas, and we'd be able to figure out a way to make it work to everyone's, you know, the best that we can. And I think what happened is, you've got a scientist that's not usually used to doing TV. You've got a brilliant producer, documentarian that's not used to doing short TV, and you realize you go out and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot, and then it gets pared down to 41 minutes, and that might not always be the 41 minutes that you wanted in the show. And that's, like you said, it's the post process, but it's a learning process. Those guys are great. I have not a bad thing to say about either of them. I think they got, you know, caught a little bit, you know, in a bad way. And I think, you know, they probably would change their tune a little bit. I don't know if a lot, but it's, you know, when Finding Bigfoot came out, you know, those guys kind of had similar things to say. And I think it's just when you go out and you have an investigation in mind, what you do in one night isn't what TV expects, right? So I think that there's just some give and take when you work on a first season, and Finding Bigfoot found that out, and look at them. I mean, they're shooting season four in a little bit. So it's just a matter of getting on the same page, and I think that this is just, you know, kind of a little bump in the road for all of us, and hopefully it isn't an indication for season two. It's just, you know, one of those things that we can just kind of move around.
And guess what? They still haven't found Bigfoot.
Can you believe it?
What are they doing? What are they? They're wasting everyone's time going around not finding Bigfoot. No, I'm just kidding. All right, we have had a 609 caller on hold, well, kind of the whole show. So let's see if our 609 person is still around. Are you there? Thank you so much for holding if you are. Are you?
Hello?
Hi there. Sorry for keeping you on hold for so long.
Oh, it's no problem. Just chill with my friends.
All right, what's your name, and what is your question for Aaron Ryder?
My name is Bennett. My question for Aaron is, have you ever had a boring hunt, either on Chasing UFOs or Destination Truth, or could be on film?
We have
I think the good news is you might have a boring sweep, but a boring hunt in general, that's like a rarity. But boring it's subjective, right? I think walking around in the woods in the middle of the night when somebody says that it's haunted by, you know, cannibal ghosts, or it's, you know, potentially...
Or even ghost cannibals.
Ghost cannibals, right? Or even, you know, some sort of a creature that we don't know exists. No matter what, it's going to heighten your adrenaline. It's going to get you going. And it's going to be interesting. Whether or not the TV audience thinks that's interesting, that's a whole other ballgame. But I am rarely bored out there. Between Josh's humor and the snakes and the mosquitoes and the potential ghosts and all that stuff out there, it's really, really difficult to have something boring happen out there on more than one, on just one sweep. I will say I've been on a sweep before and been like, eh, I could have been better. And then you go out on the next one and you're like, holy shit. Well, it, you know, forget about that one. This one's way better.
Yeah.
All right, that's a great question. Anything else?
Have you ever gone into a hunt thinking, this can't be real at all, but then you get there and you're like, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into?
I think I always say in the back of my head at some point in time during the investigation, oh, my God, what the F did I get myself into? I think that's inevitable. But I really try, you know, like I was saying earlier, I try not to go into something thinking this is bullshit. I really do, because I think there's a reason whether these stories are happening because of, you know, birds or bats or, you know, creaky floors, whether it's that or not, these people are experiencing something, and I think they deserve to be, you know, treated with respect, and you go in there and you do your best, and whether you find something or not, that's yet to be determined. But I try not to go into it thinking it's going to be bullshit, but I do go into it thinking, holy F, you know, I'm going to have a talking with Josh once this one's done. That more often than not happens.
Yeah. All right, great. Thank you so much. Great call. Yeah. Really appreciate that. That was wonderful. Well, speaking of Josh, you know, you guys really do seem to have a special rapport. And it's so funny. My wife actually was the one who saw a tweet from Josh that said, and by the way, I am hereby confirming that Ryder and I are not an item, and then something like, oh, wait, we aren't? We found that humor.
Yeah, I think, you know, for a long time, actually, if you searched my name on the web, if you searched Aaron Ryder, the next, you know, underneath it would say dating Josh Gates, ? It's definitely been, you know, a big question out there. Him and I have never dated. He's like the older brother I never wanted. we're just so similar. We're both Leos. His birthday is August 10th. I'm August 14th.
August 5th.
We're both A-type driven personalities who are after the same thing. And I think once you're in that, you know, position next to somebody that's working as hard, if not harder than you are, you just have a really great time. And I think, you know, with him piloting and, you know, me sitting next to him, I'm up for any adventure, you know, that we can, you know, go on. And I think that's what makes our relationship really unique, is he'll put something up in front of me and I'll never say no, because I trust the shit out of him. And it's fun, and he has a really great sense of humor. I love what we do, and I think it comes across on camera. I think if we didn't love what we do, I think it would be a completely different relationship. But when you go out there and you're in the middle of, you know, Fiji, you know, diving with sharks and, you know, sleeping under the stars, it's hard not to look around and say, gosh darn it, thank God I'm not in a cubicle from 9 to 5.
Well, I think absolutely it comes through, and it does feel genuine. And yeah, I mean, you guys really seem to connect, and you're both really funny. You're both very sarcastic and obviously adventuresome. that's kind of a given at this point. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess what do you expect? You know, people are going to make those kinds of assumptions when you add all those elements together, and that certainly makes sense that it's more like a brother-sister kind of thing. I think, you know, when I'm applying that to thinking about all those scenes that I've seen that you guys have been in, I think that makes perfect sense. But, yeah, I mean, that's a really important part of the show, is your rapport.
Absolutely. But I will say that Josh's relationship with Rex Williams is questionable. So I can neither confirm nor deny their extracurricular relationship. I will just say that.
Rumors do get started.
Ryder, where do you go for vacation?
For fun.
Yeah,
what do you
do to relax and have fun? I mean, your work is adventure, adventure, adventure. where could you possibly go for vacation?
What's left?
Yeah. Come to Cleveland.
It's funny you say that. I love Cleveland. It's funny you say that because when I get home, you know, people talk about, oh, let's go to Cuba or let's go to Colombia or let's go here or there. Those places sound so amazing, but at the same time, they sound like work to me. When I go away on vacation, I want a beach. I want a cocktail in my hand. And I like a little adventure, you know, maybe some skydiving or some zip line. But I like to relax. I also love time with my family. My family's all on the East Coast, so whenever I can get back to New York, that in and of itself is a huge vacation for me. So I would say when I'm not in New York, I'm, you know, on a beach somewhere, you know, just reading a book and trying not to think about monsters or the paranormal.
What are your plans for the future? Where do you see all this heading? You've obviously had an awful lot of success in a relatively short period of time, and you have you've become a real foundation of one of the great adventure shows out there. And now you have a new show that you're a co-star on. Where do you see all of this heading? 10, 20, 50, 100?
I think the one thing that's kind of kept me going where I go is that I really don't think too far ahead. You know, when Destination Truth came into my lap, I was actually considering another project, and it just happened that the timing worked out really well. But it wasn't like, you know, when I was a little girl, I wanted to do this. You know, looking back on it now, I was foolish not to. But I think looking ahead, I would love to see another season of Destination Truth. I know Josh would say the same thing. Chasing UFOs, we would love an opportunity to prove a lot of people wrong and to entertain the people that are happy with it and to just keep going and doing more investigations with that. And at the same time, I personally, you know, have started doing some side investigations and, you know, working with some charities and stuff. I'm just having fun and just thrilled at whatever gets thrown my way because I know as long as I keep working as hard as I do and working with people as great as I have been, that it'll really be hard to not be great.
Well, that is true. And, you know, it's important to have confidence, too, I'd say.
Oh, sure. And I've also thought about going back to college, maybe getting out, maybe going to clown college.
Clown college?
That's scary. Don't. Clowns are scary. They're creepy.
I think it's a great idea.
I could see it, you know, a little bit of a hairpin turn, but hey.
Could you imagine? I mean, I already have the falling down part.
No.
I could see you plowing through the jungle in full clown regalia.
I'd like to see that.
Now
that
would be something.
That would be great. That would be incredible. You might see that. Future, be ready for one weird night vision shot of me in clown makeup.
Crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, you got the camera. What do you call the ones that are on yourself? I love those cameras, by the way. They're so crazy.
POV. Those they're backpack POV cameras
Right, POV, right, the point of view. Got it. Well, that certainly makes sense because you see that. Yeah, and how long have those been around? I don't remember seeing it before Destination Truth.
There were some different versions that have been around on other paranormal shows that either come down from above off a helmet or off the chest and up in the air. Ours are just a little bit different. I think, you know, what you find out is ours are the most durable because they have to be when you're climbing and falling down the Great Wall of China or descending in a waterfall. They have to be pretty indestructible. So. Those were actually first built by Casey Brummels, and we've been perfecting them ever since within our own offices. So it's definitely been a little side project of ours to make great facial reaction television shots.
They're so immediate, you know. That's what's so great about it. And, I mean, there's no hiding from them. I suppose there's a little bit of, because they're night vision typically, right, or usually anyway. So you have that go green kind of thing.
They came out of necessity when we first had them because there is only two cameramen out there. So it literally was
without those cameras, we would be worried that we wouldn't have a camera on Josh or on me. So it really came out of necessity, but at the same time, what you realize is when our cameramen are trying to get the shot and flipping the camera around to look at what we're looking at, you do need something getting not only the dialogue but the big reaction. So they've come in quite handy. They're not always flattering. I can't say I always look good in green, but...
Well, it's realism, I suppose.
I have a kind of an off the wall question for you, but not really. Now, if you in a perfect world, if you had your choice, if on one of your investigations, one of your episodes, one of your shows, you could show the world, America, all the viewing audience, definitive proof of either a UFO, a ghost, or some sort of cryptid, what would you choose? Now, I know it doesn't matter because there's going to be people out there that wouldn't believe it anyway.
Okay,
but if you could go on a spaceship and interview an alien or actually do capture an alien or Bigfoot
cryptid.
Or one of these cryptids, you know, find the Loch Ness Monster, whatever it may be, what would you want to prove to the world? Unquestionably, 100%, show the world this is true. What would be your choice?
That's a terrific question. It's hard to say because you're right when you ask the question in that, you know, you could have tangible proof and still people wouldn't believe you. I think the one that's, you know, closest to the vest for me is always going to be paranormal. I think that there's just something spiritual in that connection that people have to their family or their homes, you know, that I think a lot of people have had and have that experience and feel crazy because there's no way to prove that. So I would love definitive proof, some way to prove more than once, you know, that there's an apparition or a ghost or, you know, some sort of way to measure energy that would finally put to bed, you know, any question that there is, you know, residual energy, you know, left over. I think that would be really important because to me that's where people have had the most encounters. You know, a lot of people have seen something strange, but there's something really emotional about having a connection in your bedroom or in your house or with somebody that's passed. There's something about that I think would be really great to be able to say, is really out there and prove to the, you know, to those that don't think it's real.
Absolutely. Now, I know you have some things coming up in the future on your various projects, but one that I'm intrigued by is on Chasing UFO. You're preparing a response for the WOW signal from the 70s. Can you tell us
what
you have to look forward to in August when that episode airs?
We're not exactly sure. If it's going to go along with one of the episodes, I'm not sure if the timing sound right, but yes, we're actually going to go down to the Arecibo telescope, which is the largest radio telescope in the entire world in Puerto Rico, and transmit all those brilliant messages that people put together. And it's pretty awe-inspiring because a lot of people took it really seriously, but a lot of people had fun with it. And I think it'll be a really great event that'll really commemorate the anniversary of the WOW signal, because I think whether you believe that we received a signal or not, it's really exciting to think that we're being proactive and trying to send something out there, whether it's, you know, just to ignite the minds of kids everywhere or, you know, something more. I just think it's a really cool concept.
You know, just something off the top of my head here, I was just thinking as you all were talking, another difficulty with the UFO show versus more a paranormal kind of show is it's not as though you can just go out there and summon UFOs, whereas if you are in a active paranormal location, if you spend enough time there, the odds are a lot better that you're going to have something worth presenting and have some experiences than if you're, you know, running around trying to find UFOs. That must be a lot harder, and I would think a source of frustration.
It is, and, you know, I think that's why we try to be creative with how we were trying to gather the evidence, because if you do just go out and skywatch, you know, the chances are whatever they are. But if you try to find these locations where eyewitnesses say that some sort of a craft crashed or landed, or some radiation was potentially used, or, you know, a car was affected or clothing was affected, that's the kind of tangible stuff that we try to incorporate along with the sightings. Because, like you say, it's not just a house that's had this activity consistent, and you can go back there and potentially capture it if you're there long enough. If UFOs were seen above Phoenix, Arizona in, you know, 1997, that doesn't mean that they're going to be there in 2012. So, yeah, there is some difficulty there. And I think the biggest science of it is, you know, repetition, being able to prove that it happens more than one time. And that's much, much harder to do with unidentified flying objects that are seen so infrequently.
Well, my goodness, that was about the fastest hour in the history of the world. It was like poop, it was like poop through a goose.
Like a TV hour.
That's what I'm thinking. That was amazing. Thank you so much, Aaron. What a pleasure. Of course, we could go on and on and on. But gosh, I think that was a really great hour. I think we really did cover quite a bit. What an engaging personality you are. I really, really enjoyed it. It was an awful lot of fun, and we appreciate the time and the effort, and certainly wish you only the best, and we will be following closely your career.
Well, thank you guys so much. I'm very excited with America's Most Haunted, and I will absolutely be keeping track of what you guys do as well. And I will say that Tuesdays at 9 o'clock, we've got 3 more Destination Truth episodes to go. We've got vampires coming up in Romania, and overnight investigation at the Mayan ruins of Tikal. Season finale is on my birthday, August 14th. So stay tuned to that. And then Chasing UFOs, we have episodes of Fridays at 10 o'clock on National Geographic. So 2 times a week you can check me out for all the investigations and cussing.
You can get your writer fix.
You sure can.
Right,
thank you so much.
Have a great evening.
Bye, Ben, Sarah, and Teresa, and Kathy. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Good night. Thanks, Teresa and Kathy. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, listeners. Farewell.